I'm John Kroll. On today's No Limits, we're going to look to the past. We're going to talk about the ways searching out sometimes forgotten parts of family history and even family secrets can connect us with ourselves and remind us of what family means. My guests are Susan Johnson Hadler, the author of the new book, The Beauty of What Remains, Family Lost, Family Found, and Indianapolis-based historian Glory June Greif. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is wfyi. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We've got a fascinating show for you today. We're going to be talking about really what you can uncover, not just about the past, but about yourself and the forces that helped make you by looking into family history and in some ways family secrets. If you'd like to join this conversation, perhaps share a little bit of your family history and your family secrets, you can do so by giving us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, my guests are Hoosier author Susan Johnson Hadler, who's the author of a new book, The Beauty That Remains. Did I get that right?
The Beauty of What Remains?
Of What Remains, I'm sorry. My apologies. That is just out and explores her personal journey. And Indianapolis-based historian, presenter, Glory June Greif. Welcome to both of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Should be fun.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, Susan, I'm going to start with you. I want to talk a little bit, and I've been trying to figure out. Your book starts with, what is a very personal search for your father, who was killed in World War II before you were even old enough to meet him or really have memories of him. And it's a story of discovery. Could you talk a little bit about, before we get into the search, what prompted you to write the book? You know, it was one thing to search for, obviously, your roots and your sense of family. It's another thing to communicate it in a book.
Yes, thanks. I wrote the book about the part about my father's search, because I knew that there were so many others of us. At one point, I discovered that there were almost 200,000 of us who had lost fathers in World War II, and not much statistics had not been kept for those of us whose fathers died in World War II, and we were left alone with our experiences growing up without a father. And our experiences of knowing that our fathers had been killed when we were very young or before we were born. And many of them were left overseas, so we had no information about it. And so I wrote this book and the first book I wrote, which was Lost in the Victory, so that other people who had this experience would not feel so alone.
And, you know, we probably ought to tell a little bit about your father's story here. I mean, he died young, as he was only 25 years old. And the circumstances of his death were, I'm struggling to find the word, poignant does not serve at all. But the circumstances of his death led to that sense of oblivion, of just disappearance at some level. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. When I was young, I only knew that he had been clearing a field with two other men when a mine exploded and he was blown up. I later found out that he had been detonating a mine, an anti-tank mine, which is a very large mine, and it had been allegedly booby-trapped. So my father, who was a lieutenant, and two other men also lost their lives together, and there was just nothing, virtually nothing remained of them.
And there wasn't a tremendous amount of encouragement from your mother conduct this search.
No, because for my mother and for many women who were in this situation with young children whose fathers went off to war in Europe or in the Pacific, places that they had never visited, places they didn't know about, when their spouses died, they were just left with nothing, virtually no bodies, no services to help them grieve. The other men were just, the soldiers were coming back from the war and everyone was getting on with their lives. And so my mother, along with many others, just locked it away inside. And so that it was very painful. And so any mention of the war, any mention, any questions about my father were, I learned very quickly not to ask. And when I did begin the search, it did bring up some difficulties between us, which we later resolved.
As I was reading your book, and I'm sure this is going to be the case for a lot of people who are listening, I had a sense of resonance. My father's mother, my grandmother, lived and died in mysterious and tragic circumstances that I'm not going to go into because I try very hard to make this show about the guests and the subject and not about the host. But it has been one of those things that creates kind of a shadow over the rest of the family. I can't tell you how many times my cousins and I have sat in the same room with a glass of wine in hand or whatever and speculated on those circumstances and what happened. And I've got to believe that this is a more universal experience than we realize. Gloria, I noticed you were nodding your head while I was saying that. Some of it is obviously our fascination with the past and trying to understand.
Yeah.
But there is also a kind of willed amnesia, too, when it comes to what came before us, a determination not to know or understand.
Yeah, there is some truth to that. I have always felt very connected to my past, World War II, and farther back than that. My grandparents, my maternal grandparents lived next door to me, so I was conscious of the history. I was conscious of the larger context, which I guess a lot of people don't pay attention to, but I guess that's how I got into history. But I was conscious of the larger context of World War I, in which my grandfather served in the National Guard, even as a German immigrant, which was interesting. I was conscious of the 20s and the race riots in Chicago, in which my grandfather almost got killed. I was conscious of that. I was conscious of the Chicago World's Fair, the Depression, and so on, because these were all part of my grandparents' and parents' lives. And they were mentioned all the time. World War II was very present to me because without World War II, my parents wouldn't have met. They met in the service. They were both in the Navy. So it's a continuity for me to keep this alive, I think. It's very, and to shut that out, and especially intentionally, is a part of you missing if you do.
Now, you're working on your own book.
I am.
A similar theme.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's tentatively titled Dear Mugs, Love Cuddles, because those are the nicknames my parents had for each other. My father and mother met in the Navy in Norfolk, Virginia. My mother was of the first contingency of waves who were stationed at Norfolk. So you can imagine a group of 20 waves and thousands of men. Lots of possibilities there. She met my father.
One way to work. Yeah.
Well, she told me she had lots of dates, but she had no intention of getting married. Her own family history of marriage was not all that great. She didn't see anything special. And she was going to be a career woman after the war was over. And then she met my father, and that was it. They were engaged within less than 2 months and were married the following year, after which she asked for and got an honorable discharge, went home to live with her family back in South Bend. So they began to write to each other. Day after day after day, my mother wrote my father every single day, twice a day, three times a day. And they went off to the ship. My father, unlike a lot of men, did the same. He wrote her every single day and sometimes several times a day. When there was mail call, when they reached a port, my dad would get a whole bag of mail to himself. A lot of these survived. Some 500 survived. There were thousands.
That is a window into a different era, a time when actually people, that is the way people communicated it. I often wonder how easy it's going to be for future historians to recreate our time, because
exactly.
So much of it is disposable.
It worries me to death as a historian, because these letters are invaluable insights into just everyday life. And they will be the bulk of the book. And I'm connecting the dots. So it's a memoir of actually someone else that I'm doing for them. My mother, long before she died, had always dreamed of doing this, and I'm doing it for her. So,
if you are just joining us, we are talking about the satisfactions and challenges of exploring family history and family secrets and finding out what they reveal about us and also about the people who came before us. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So, Susan, in this, you know, there was a sense of loss on your part that and... You know, the way you write about it, the image that kept coming to my head is that there's like this hole that you are desperately trying to fill here. Walk me through the process of, A, how you first began exploring not just your father's death, but the life he led before that.
Well, I started, this process started when I went to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in 1992, and I saw veterans hugging each other and tears, and I realized that that it looked more like they were bonding than the silence that I had known. And from that point, I decided that I wanted to begin to search for my father. And so I discovered the American War Orphans Network, which is if anybody is listening out there who has also lost a parent in World War II, it's a network that helps you know how to do the research, how to send for records, and supports you in the process. It's awon.org, AWON.org.
Go ahead and give that to them again. People don't actually ride around in their cars with pencils handy.
American World War II Orphans Network, AWON.org. And they provided support and information, and it is with the founder that I wrote the book Lost in the Victory, which we interviewed about 25 different people. And they told their stories of what it was like. That was the beginning of the search. From there, my husband and I went to Europe, and we followed the route of my father's battalion across France into Luxembourg and Germany, and actually found the place that he died. And that's quite a story that's in the book.
And had an interesting, apparently, husband-wife chat at the Monet Museum, too, as I recall.
Yes, we did. I just insisted that he be the follower and I be the leader. And so he decided that that would work for him. So it worked for both of us.
What was it like? I mean, that had to have been a wrenching experience in some ways.
That was incredible, because that was absolutely incredible, because we found the camp where he stayed for 3 months, because the train that he was coming from the port to the camp had been in an accident. So he was there for 3 months. While he was there, he wrote me a letter of welcome when I was born. I never saw him. And so to be able to, we found the actual camp, which is an amazing story, and I stood on the grounds that he stood and saw the same spire from the church in the distance that he had seen, and that just made me feel very close to him.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about uncovering family secrets and family history. I am talking with Hoosier author Susan Johnson Hadler. She is the author of the new book, The Beauty of What Remains, and Indianapolis-based historian and presenter Glory June Greif, who is working on her own book. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
Good afternoon. It's 19 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to No Limits on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, made possible by your sustaining membership and by the new Sandra Eskenazi Center for Brain Care Innovation, dedicated to transforming brain care for all, starting right here in Indianapolis. More at brain.eskenazihealth.edu or at 317-880-2224. And by Iron Strike, dedicated to helping organizations and companies engage employees, retain talent, and improve business results. More at ironstrike.biz. And by Bosma Enterprises, offering warehousing, packaging, and logistics services that help create jobs for the blind. Information available at bosma.org/outsourcing. Email your questions to nolimits@wfyi.org. No Limits with John Kroll continues.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about the satisfactions and challenges of uncovering family history and family secrets. My guests are author Susan Johnson Hadler. She is the author of a new book, The Beauty of What Remains. And we also have in the studio with us Indianapolis-based historian, presenter, Glory June Greif, who is working on her own book about her family. Just before we went to the break, we were talking about, Susan, you were talking about going to Europe, to France, and following the trail, really, of your father's last days. I mean, you went to what was called Camp Lucky Strike, and named after cigarette companies in those days. And how it gave you a sense of closeness with him. Was that essential? I'm going to ask both of you on this because you are sort of exploring. And, the cliche always, well, the saying, I won't say it's a cliche, is that the past is another country. It's a place that if we can visit but not become part of. Did you need something like that to bring things into focus? Glory June, when I get to you, I'm going to ask really, what enhances your sense of connection with the people of the past? But Susan, I'll start with you.
Well, I very much immersed myself in my father's past. I had his records, and I just put myself there. And when we were in Europe, I was in my father's past, and I intended to do that because I wanted to get as close as I could to him. And I really feel that the past is alive in the present because of my experiences. After going to Camp Lucky Strike, we went to the little town, which was the closest we could find to where my father had died. And I had just a few clues. And it was an amazing experience to walk into a German police station. A German police officer was one of the ones that had participated in an investigation of his death. And to be given a map of a secret area, an area that the Belgians had controlled after World War II, and it was off limits for everybody. I never could have found it without the help of these German police officers. And so we actually found the very spot that he died. I was just in that time, and if I hadn't been, I wouldn't have been able to find it. but somehow there was a connection. I was making a connection beyond what my head could have made. I was kind of following the past, following his spirit, following my own, you know, desire to find these things out. And it worked. It happened.
Gloria June.
I have always been surrounded by objects of the past and went digging through them. My mother was quite a talented photographer and used my dad constantly as a subject, as you can imagine, because she was madly in love with him. So I certainly knew what my dad looked like during the war, at least while he was stationed here in the States. I can envision that very handsome young man who my mother always noted resembled William Holden when he was younger. And as a matter of fact, he did. Mm-hmm. When I saw a movie, this really struck me. This is really bringing the past into the present, and that I saw this very early film of William Holden. Because I didn't see it. I saw William Holden as an older man. I didn't see the resemblance.
Yeah, the guy who was on the talk shows in the 70s and in Network and all of that.
But when I saw him in this movie made in the late 40s, I was, oh my goodness, that's my dad. I could see the resemblance. Mm-hmm. No wonder she fell for him. He's really handsome. So there was that. They had a remarkable relationship. So when I finally was allowed to read the letters, she presented them to me much into my adulthood. And, of course, she had censored them. She had burned several, you know, a little too spicy, perhaps. And then I saw the language. My father, who was rather, I mean, he had a melodious voice, but he would not speak unless he had something to say. So not exactly taciturn, but measured. And to see him pouring out in these letters, beautifully expressed, all this emotion was just very, it really opened something up to me. I always knew how he felt about my mother. I just sensed it. But to see this in writing was really remarkable, made me feel very close to him. And sometimes when I look at the letter, I can picture, since I have in my mind the picture of him as that young sailor, I can picture him sitting there in some downtime on the battleship he was on and thinking about coming back, taking my mother in his arms and all that. He wrote a beautiful expressive passage one night. It was moonlight over the Pacific. He was saying, oh, there's a beautiful moon here. Oh, if I were home, I would know what to do in this moonlight. Make a note of that. On all beautiful moonlit nights, we will find something exciting to do or something along those lines. And I said, oh, my gosh, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's not normally how you want to think of your parents.
Well, much later, it was actually beautiful to read. My father was gone by that time, so it was really special. So my mother went through all these letters later on, as I say, burned quite a few. I don't think all of them had survived initially, but as I say, about 500 did. So there's that, and they are tactile. The photographs are visual. But there's also just a sense of presence. Sometimes I do a program, since I'm so slow in getting the book completed, mm-hmm. I do this program wherein I incorporate passages from the letters and mm-hmm. sing songs of the period that were special to them and so on. Sometimes when I'm in the middle of a song, I just have a very hard time finishing it because it's so emotional. They're so present to me.
Do the dead, I'm going to ask kind of a strange question here, but when you were saying that some of the letters had been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was thinking of the fact, Thomas Jefferson, for example, when his wife died, mm-hmm. Burned, destroyed all of the letters back and forth between them, I think except two, if I am not mistaken. And sort of the mystery of that relationship is one of history's great mysteries. Similarly, I think, you know, Benjamin Franklin had a son, and we don't even know who the mother was.
Yes.
You know, and I guess where I'm going with this is, do the dead have some rights, the things that they wanted to obscure, that they did not want us to know about? Do they have, and I'm sort of leading that into trying to talk, Susan, about also the difficulties you had with your mother and some of the members of your family who were not enthusiastic about your research, did not want you, you know, digging up the past and digging up things that they found painful. I'll start with you, Susan.
Well, we did have differing points of view, my mother and I think that the silence meant different things. Talking about the letters, I have two letters that my father wrote, and both of them my mother had kept. The first one my father wrote to me when I was just after I was born, as I mentioned, and that was taped into my baby book. So that was a wonderful link to my father. And my father was very expressive and expressed his hopes for me very beautifully. And then another letter that mother sent me later that he had written very close to the time he died. I saw no other letters, so my mother really got rid of every other letter, which was sad to me because I think that, you know, he was hers, he belonged to her, and she needed that. And there are some places that just belong to the two of them. And my mother protected that, and she needed to, and I completely understand that. From my perspective, I was sad because I so longed for a sense of him. Because I never saw him, I never heard him speak. I just wanted to know what he was like. You know, what made him laugh? What made him, what did he enjoy? Any little tiny snippet of anything. And I thought that maybe a letter might show that. So I was sad for myself, but I completely understand that my mother needed to keep him for herself.
Do you have a copy of that letter here with you?
I do. The one that he wrote to me.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's important for people to hear this. If you would not mind reading that, if it's okay.
It's right here. I'd love it.
Okay, because I think that's sort of the thing that sends you off on this quest.
That's so true. So. Right. This was written when he was at Camp Lucky Strike, and it gives you a sense of the time. His language is also a sense of the time. Dear Susan, since I can't be there in person, this is a sort of welcome letter. Yours is a pretty good family as families run. Your dad is a bit on the offside, but your mother and brother and now you more than make up for that. Your brother is quite a guy. Of course, he's quite handsome and smart. Will he get around? But I know he'll always be ready to guide you and protect you in every way. Your mother is the most wonderful person I've ever known. I've always marveled at my great good fortune to have loved her and been loved by her. If you will follow her dictates and examples, you may expect to meet life in the best possible way, and your path will always be the right one. Your family believes in living life to its fullest. We enjoy all good things and live well. In that, you're fortunate. For me, adhere to a belief in tolerance, a genuine liking for others, and always give to life to the fullest. Your father, Dave.
It's interesting because as I was reading that, both as a, you know, as a child and as a father myself, you know, trying to sort of balance those two roles, and I'm thinking as a father in some ways, he's acknowledging between the lines there, there's a chance he won't be coming back and
yeah,
that he will not see.
Right.
You get that sense of him. And yet he wanted you to have clearly some tangible symbol of the fact that you were his child.
And that's what's so valuable. That's right. I got that sense later in life. I didn't when I was young. It was just his words, his very words, which just, you know, it touched me so deeply. But later, when I reread it and studied it, I really got the sense that he wasn't, you know, that he might have known that he wouldn't make it back.
In a short note, there's an awful lot going on.
Exactly.
On there. I want to ask, you know, at what point did you begin to feel like you had met the guy or knew the guy who was in those letters?
Oh, that's
that letter?
Great. That's great. I also attended the reunion of his battalion at a point, and I met men who had known him, and they, one man just saw me, and tears just started rolling down his face, and he said, your eyes are just like your father's. And when I spoke to men that he served with on the phone, and they called him Dave, it was like, oh, he really had lived. And then I went to his hometown and found people who knew him and spent time with them, and they told me stories, and I just loved hearing every word, and he really came to life. And I do feel now as though I do have a sense of him, and I do know him, and it's, you know, it's easy to talk about him now, which it wasn't before, because I had nothing to say. I had no memories, but I do have a sense of him.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the challenges and the satisfactions of looking at family history, perhaps uncovering family secrets. If you'd like to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Molly has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Molly, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, John. And I am a fan of Glory June. I went to hear her presentation about World War II, where she wears her mother's uniform and sings songs, and I got very weepy, because I am so proud of the fact that I have had so many World War II era folks in my life. Dad, uncles, and aunts, on and on. My father-in-law was in the Czech Army, of all things. One friend of mine parachuted into Normandy before D-Day. But anyway, I think my primary comment is that my sense is that all these guys and women went to this horrible war and saw all this awful stuff. But when they did come back, it was very much their job to get married, settle down, have children, as my parents did. They did not necessarily sit around in therapy groups and talk about, you know, what they had been through. It was their job to go about with the living of life. And that was their job. And it's just, you know, it's just interesting for me to look at all that.
Thanks very much for the call, Molly. And thank you for sharing your story.
That's why they were fighting.
Yeah.
To get back to normal.
Just to come back. Well, and there's a part, you know, in talking with my father and other World War II era veterans, you know, they're sort of happy for some of the attention to their service now, but there is an undercurrent of they almost feel like, you know, all of the focus on the Greatest Generation and all of that has romanticized their experience rather than reflecting the traumatic upheaval that it truly was. You know, is there a sense of that? I mean, do we not look at that time in its proper focus and realize it was not a pleasant time in a lot of ways to be alive?
Well, it was not. It was not. Certainly not pleasant for the people in combat, and certainly not all that pleasant for the folks back home. There were a lot of shortages. Life was really in great upheaval. This was a war, unlike later conflicts, you couldn't ignore it.
Yeah, it wasn't a limited war.
You couldn't pretend it wasn't there.
It
affected everybody one way or another. So it was something that you had to be aware of, even if you didn't follow the battles and follow the course of the war. You knew, as the expression went, don't you know there's a war on? They sure did.
Susan, does that sort of feeling that, you know, this was some grand adventure, a victory for democracy, make it a little harder for you to probe the painful parts of it?
Absolutely. That's right. That's why we called the first book Lost in the Victory, because there was our fathers were seen by some people as heroes, and it was just a kind of a blanket identity, and it didn't reach us in any way in terms of what we were going through and wondering what happened to our fathers, where they were buried, you know, how they died. All the questions we had were just kind of brushed aside because they were heroes.
Yeah, and even in the, I mean, obviously many of them died, and you know, that's difficult. I'm also thinking, you know, the focus here is too narrow. We lost, the world lost something like 40 million people during the course of it. So there were a lot of grieving widows, a lot of orphans, and all of that. Did that, you know, the sheer size of it. We've not had anything like that.
Thank
account
goodness.
To the trauma of, mm-hmm. of dealing with it, Susan. Was it did the scope, the numbers make it difficult to figure out what was going on?
Oh, absolutely. There was just, you know, that's a funny thing that's kind of a paradox because while there were so many and there were so many war orphans left in the States as well as all over the world, at the same time, we, most of us, knew nobody else that had the same experience. So while there was, and we would go to movies and see the...
See it glamorized at
yes.
some level. We are talking about uncovering family history and family secrets here on No Limits. I am John Krall. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about uncovering family history, looking into family secrets here on No Limits. My guests are Hoosier author Susan Johnson Hadler. She's just published a new book, The Beauty of What Remains, that is about her search for information about her family members who either had died or had drifted away. That's another part where we haven't really talked about yet. And also Indianapolis-based historian and presenter Glory June Greif, who is working on her own book. Just before we went to the break, we went to the sort of the glamorization of World War II, the romanticizing of the experience when it was a tremendously traumatic experience for people all over the world, including here. Glory June, you said you wanted to talk a little bit about how the movies present that era.
Yes. Well, Hollywood went to war as well. And, of course, as we know, a lot of our most famous actors of the time never actually saw combat except in the movies. But that was the whole point. They were a big propaganda machine. So there were feature films, of course, about the war. And while they showed battle and people died in the films and all that, it was all very heroic. Heroism was the word of the day. But also, Hollywood producers created a number of home front films that were designed to get people to buy war bonds and that. Like, these were shorts that were presented before the feature films. And there was a whole series by Frank Capra, the Why We Fight series, which I've seen a number of those. A friend of mine specializes in showing these films. And they are the most amazing propaganda. I mean, if you aren't moved by watching these and aren't ready to get out there and join the Army or the Navy in the next moment, since there's something wrong with your sensibilities. They're just very cleverly designed to get you revved up and in favor. We will win this and everything will be wonderful thereafter. Of course, it isn't that simple. It never was. So it's really interesting the role that Hollywood played in keeping the war effort going. After all, it went on for some years, mm-hmm. and people were getting really tired of it. This is no fun. And Hollywood played a part in keeping that spirit going.
And then afterwards, even
and
with
afterwards.
The films, too, it was sort of about justifying all that we had gone through.
They were
through.
Still selling, trying to buy, yeah. sell the war bonds to pay yeah. for the rehabilitation.
Yeah, so. Well, and I think there was an emotional context
yeah,
to it,
absolutely.
Too. If you've been through something like that, you want to feel like it led somewhere as well. We are talking about really the mysteries of family and the mysteries of the past here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, we've heard from someone I think who will be familiar to Susan, her brother Dan Hinkle, who says, fascinating discussion. Please ask Susan about finding our Aunt Eleanor. Quite a story. So, how about telling us about finding your Aunt Eleanor?
Dan knows all the family secrets.
He does now.
He does now. But for a long time, he didn't know because our mother's older sister, Eleanor, had been sent to a mental hospital in 1936 when she was 23. I later found out that she had two children, a two-year-old and a five-month-old. The family completely abandoned Eleanor. Her husband unfortunately died the following June. His sister raised the children, I later found out. But we knew nothing about Eleanor, nothing, except that she had been a concert pianist when she was young. So I was looking for her grave after looking for my father. I was searching for her grave, and I found her alive and well at age 94. She was in a nursing home, and she was affectionate. She had a touch of dementia, but she was funny. She was just delightful. And she still played the piano. She sang "You Are My Sunshine" every night. And if you really look at every verse of "You Are My Sunshine," it kind of tells aspects of her story. It's not all a happy song. And then I found out that she had children, and I made it my mission to find them, and I did. The children had been told that she had died. So her daughter came, Sandra, came to visit her mother. She saw her for the first time in 72 years. Sandra's daughter, Amy, Eleanor's granddaughter, also came to see her grandmother for the first time. Eleanor looked at her granddaughter, and her granddaughter had brought a picture of her son, Eleanor's great grandson. Eleanor looked at the picture. She turned to Amy and said, "Take me home." It was extraordinary. And the search for Eleanor, the way I found her, is in the book.
And we want to encourage people to read the book.
You can read the book.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener who wanted both of you to talk about some of the procedural hurdles in finding out information about, you know, World War II era casualties. Obviously, it's not effortless. That's a time that predates computerization and all of that. How would you recommend, if there is someone who wants to go on a journey similar to yours, how would you recommend they get started?
I would recommend they start with the organization, the American War Orphans Network, AWON.org. The people there have done this. They've done this for their fathers. They know how to do it. They have access to all the information that anyone would need to begin the search for their father.
A lot of the records, our own Richard Lugar has been instrumental in starting a program for American Veterans Records. So a lot of the substantial records can be found. I'm sorry, I can't recall the URL, but if you Google Lugar and the American Veterans Project, I think you'll be able to find it. That's one good place to start. It is a lot easier nowadays in the computer world. These records have existed in Washington for all these decades, but now a lot of them are online, so you can find them. You can write to the various branches of service and find those military records.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about uncovering family history and exploring the mysteries of family here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Doing my family history, one of the stories was that they left the Virginia area because there was a lot of insanity in the family. And I found that one of my female ancestors had been in the Virginia insane asylum, home for the insane asylum, or something along that line, sorry. But her husband, who survived her, had multiple marriages and had multiple families and always named every, it's almost like he had litters of children, and every time he had children, he named them all the same names. And
that's helpful.
Like, you know, there'd be three Eleanors and there'd be three Richards, you know, that sort of thing. And so I'm not really sure who belonged in the asylum. I did call them and, you know, I tried to find out what happened to her, why she was put in there, but there had been a fire. And this was just right before the Civil War as well. And so there was really no records of any of the any patient records outside of, you know, just census records and stuff like that. So I was never able to get to what actually happened.
And that, Cheryl, thank you very much for the call and for sharing your story. Gloria June, I'm going to throw this one to you, but it strikes me that is one of the frustrations, having done a little bit of research
on
family
yes.
history and all of that, is so much of it can be so promising, and then there are points where you do just literally run into a wall.
Absolutely. A lot of times it will be something like a fire. Even as recently as just the 20th century generations, CCC records, Civilian Conservation Corps, who a lot of those young men went into the military in World War II immediately, so I've known a great many World War II veterans. Their records are lost because there was a fire in the where they were stored, so they're just gone. If I can find the guys to tell me their stories, that's another thing, but there is no central location for these. I started out researching the CCC in Indiana, fully expecting there to be some clearinghouse area, and that did not exist. There have been attempts to create one since, but again, successive fires and that sort of thing. In terms of researching insane asylums and such, they used to dump everybody into insane asylums. I was working on one up in South Bend, and oh my Lord, heartbreaking to read the patient entry records.
Well, the diagnoses for much of our history were not particularly enlightened or sensitive. I've seen some of those records, and you know, particularly if someone was to be committed, there were like three options. One of them was drunkenness, another was feeble-mindedness, and all of them are just loaded with this really heavy sense of moral judgment.
Exactly, too. Exactly.
That's right.
We've gotten an email from a listener. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. This listener named Paul says, I only really became curious about my family history after the death of my father in 2012. My mother had passed in 2008. To be brief, the two biggest surprises that my research uncovered were first the fact that my mother's older sister, who was always the virtual matriarch of that side of the family, had a different father who had died while she was an infant. Second, I learned that my paternal grandparents were divorced and then remarried during the time between the birth of my father's older sister and his own birth 8 years later. If I have a question, it would be about how deliberately or casually family secrets are kept in the shadows, not talked about. Susan, I'm going to start with you, but I'm going to give both of you a crack at that one.
Yeah. How deliberately or casually? Well, in my experience with my family, I think shame has a lot to do with it. And what you said about the moral, the moral sense of what was going on has a lot to do with it in the earlier days. The sense of right and wrong and was a problem. And also we knew so much less about things like mental illness. And I think this is a generational situation. I think that when it happened to the people it happened to, they really didn't often know what to do with it, and they would just hide it. And then I think later generations really want to know. And I was just going to add that I think libraries are a wonderful source. There are genealogists at libraries that can help you. And also that persistence and finding a multiple range of people and places to help you find. You take over.
Laura Jean,
No, it's funny. The listener's story relates somewhat to my own family history. I knew very little about my father's family, and he unfortunately died only in his early 60s, so I didn't have much chance to ask. Fortunately, his oldest sibling was still alive, and I drove my mother up to see her in Minnesota in the 90s, and we went up two or three times to visit. She was always my favorite aunt as well. And I was asking her about the family history, and she brought out the marriage license of my father's father. And I noticed, this is the year after you were born. So I,
yeah, that's always interesting. Yeah,
my father's oldest sister was illegitimate, and then they married later on, after the child was born, who was actually in another state. So he crossed state lines, and he was a good 10 years older than my father's mother. So it was a very intriguing story. I'll never know because no one is around to tell me, and nobody's going to share that with me if they did know it.
Is that one of the things that's the hardest for people to sort of grasp, is that the past was every bit as vibrant and confused as the present is? You know, I used to say when we'd be talking about this stuff, the first thing to understand is that your ancestors were every bit as screwed up and confused as you
are. Yeah, do you think you invented it?
But there is this sense somehow when we look at the past, because there have been outcomes or whatever, that we sense that, you know, we tend to believe that they were foreordained, that it couldn't have happened any other way. And that the people had to have that sense of certainty, oh, this is going to be okay, or this is going to end badly, when they couldn't know either. Susan, you're looking at me now with an interesting look on your face. So I wanted to, what's going through your head right
well,
now?
Well, I was just very, I was actually listening to you and wondering where you were going with this.
Well, I guess what I was trying to get at here is the theme that we've talked about here is that we all do have, it's almost like William Faulkner's famous thing that the past isn't dead, it isn't even past. We all have a relationship with what goes before. And we're getting close on time here, so I guess I'm going to ask as we wrap up, you know, at what point did your relationship with the past, with those folks who came before you, click into focus, and what has it meant to you?
Well, it clicked into focus, especially with the search for my father, that what it has meant to me is that I'm a whole person. I found the other half of me, and I understand what happened, and I've resolved the family conflicts and the family mysteries, and that has given me a sense of belonging.
Glory Jean.
Well, I was always very conscious of the past, as I alluded to, but I'm not sure I internalized it until, for instance, in reading the letters and reading my father speak of the aspirations of when he gets home and they will raise a family and they will do this and that, and that's all he was looking forward to, just ordinary things and an ordinary good life. And it just made me appreciate him so much more, and as I say, I internalized it at that time, seeing these letters, because he did not write very much after that. He did not speak very much about such aspirations. You sort of knew how he felt, but
he became dad, basically.
Yeah.
We settle into that role, and people forget that we all have other lives as
exactly.
well. Susan, your book just came out, right?
Right.
Can you tell people real quickly where they can find it?
You can find it at indiebooks.com, and you can find it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
And if they want to hear you, are you doing author appearances here in the city at all? I know you did one.
I did one at the Propylaeum last night.
Any more?
I'll do one at Kingston's tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night?
Yes.
What time?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Well, I'd like to thank you both. This has been a fascinating conversation. I've enjoyed talking with both of you. Susan Johnson Hadler and Glory Jean Greif have been my guests. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.